And if we're going to change people's opinions, we can't get mad at them. We can't shut them out. We can't just call them ignorant. Those things may be true, but you need to help them understand what our thinking is and what our world is like from their perspective, and sort of in baby steps.
Welcome to episode 56 of the Hunt Back Country podcast, presented to you as always by Exo Mountain Gear. Tonight's guest is Wes Seiler. He's a writer, but he doesn't write in hunting magazines. He writes in places like GQ and Wired and Outside Magazine. And he doesn't live in the backcountry either. He lives in Hollywood. So, at this point, you're probably wondering, what the heck is Wes doing on this show? Well, Wes is a hunter, and he enjoys backcountry hunting. And he's actually a great advocate for conservation and for hunting amongst a very anti-hunting crowd. Wes is doing great things, reaching people that most you and I would never reach, might never talk to. And we hear some great principles from Wes about why it's difficult to get his friends involved in hunting, how he's been a positive influence for conservation, and much more. We also hear about some of his trips and adventures and lessons that he's learned, like picking up a bow just 6 months before his first archery hunt. So this is a different, entertaining, yet informational, and hopefully somewhat inspirational episode. Hope you enjoy this one with Wes Seiler. Let's get right to it. Well, Wes, thank you so much for joining us tonight. How are you, man?
I'm good, thanks. Just sitting here in Hollywood, California, with my dog and a beer.
Yeah. Perfect night, man. I'm sure that most of our audience is probably sitting in Hollywood right now, so that works out great.
I'd imagine that the audience for a hunting podcast is, exactly, is 99% Hollywood-based.
They're probably outside your door. So speaking of that, you know, it's funny if you get on a line and start reading your information or like reading interviews with you. There's some interesting info. One line that I love that you actually wrote an article, it says, "I'm not the kind of person you would likely think of when you try and picture a hunter. I live in Hollywood, California, in a hot pink Craftsman. I go to trendy bars and eat at fancy restaurants and blog for a living. My first real career job was at a fashion magazine in London." So yeah, I would think on that quote, from what you're describing, it's an interesting mixture. So we will certainly get to how you got involved in hunting, but first, just would love to hear a bit about your background. It's pretty interesting. You've been called a professional wild man that pretty much tested motorcycles and drove cars and stuff for a living. You've written for, you know, like Wired and GQ and Rolling Stone. So kind of give us the story for the listeners who are unfamiliar just with you personally and professionally before we dive into hunting.
Yes, I'm a professional writer. I started, you know, like you just said, at a fashion magazine in London. I was like the world's dorkiest little kid. You know, I had like a bowl haircut and like acne and wore like very unfortunate clothes. And this art professor that I was in love with at university was like, "Hey, I got you an internship." And I was like, "Okay, I'll do whatever you tell me, pretty lady." and it was at a fashion magazine. I walked in the first day and I was like, "Oh my God, there's models here."
This is great. Best internship ever.
Yeah, exactly. So I looked at the guys around me and I was like, you know, these guys like go out with models and stuff. If I got my act together and like didn't dress so bad and got my hair cut and wasn't such a jerk off, maybe I could one day date a model too. So I did that for a while. And then my original passion was cars. You know, grew up restoring cars with my dad. So, you know, my childhood goal with my career was always to be a road test editor at a car magazine. I did that. Found it kind of empty, moved on to motorcycles for a while, started a website that eventually became the largest website in the motorcycle space, and sold that a few years ago.
Yeah, that's actually how I found you. I used to follow you there.
On Helpful Leather?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. What do you ride?
So I've ridden kind of a bunch of different things. My parents, you know, always rode. Like, so when I was growing up, I, you know, was on a mini bike as early as I can remember and stuff like that. And I got my motorcycle license like right when I was 16 and got my first bike and actually used to ride with my parents a bunch. So
awesome.
I've had several bikes over the years on road and off road, and pretty much anything on two wheels is fun.
Yeah, I love it. I love pretty much everything. I've got a KTM 990 Adventure right now that I'm sort of fixing up a little bit. You know, and then I drive my, you've seen pictures of my giant lifted Land Rover that I cruise around Hollywood in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Making plans right now. We're going to Baja for Thanksgiving, some friends of mine and I. Sweet. So that's our next trip in that. But yeah, you know, I did the motorcycle world for a while. It was a lot of fun. I hurt myself a bunch of times, and just the world itself was very small, and I found it very frustrating. So I just gotten rid of that company, and I was out in Joshua Tree with my dog just camping, and we were just hiking around, and he came over some boulders, and he found this really group of weird people, And, you know, we started to hit it off, and they liked my dog, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, 15 minutes into the conversation, they went away and had a meeting about me, and they came back and were like, hey, we had a meeting about you. And I was like, I know, you guys are so weird. like, what's going on here is this is a Native American worship group. And, you know, we think you're cool. We want to invite you to join our ceremony tonight. So long story short, I went an 8-hour ayahuasca fueled spirit quest in sort of a very impromptu fashion, and, woke up in the morning, called my business partner, told him to go fuck himself, and, decided to become an outdoors journalist.
Wow. So you kind of sort of literally stumbled into it.
Totally. So from that, I launched a website called Indefinitely Wild, which was initially part of the Gawker, media group, a whole bunch of city-based blogs that talk a bunch of shit about, gadgets and celebrity gossip and a bunch of stuff that I don't necessarily read.
Yeah.
But you know, it was a big company. We recruited a lot of readers, and, last year Outside Magazine decided that we should be a part of that. So they, you know, maybe an offer I couldn't refuse. Now I'm a part of Outside.
Yeah. Which is a super cool publication.
It's great. You know, it's sort of our biggest mainstream magazine talking about, you know, outdoors pursuits to, again, you know, people who live in cities and you have the money to sort of pursue them quite well.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's definitely a magazine that would reach people that would probably be traditionally described as liberals. Yeah. And so covering hunting in it is always an interesting challenge. Not just from, you know, they my contract with Outside basically says I can do whatever I want, so they can't really say no to me, but, you know, just trying to make the kind of stuff that the readers won't reject and can understand and find approachable, you know, that's sort of a challenge.
Yeah. And I think there's a balance there, and we'll definitely get to that. So first of all, before we get to you writing about the hunting and Outside and other places, how did you yourself get into hunting, like make that transition?
You know, I was always really into the outdoors. You know, I have a great father who, you know, really gave me that gift as a kid. We go on huge trips every year and all the time. We're just spending, you know, tons of time in the woods. He's not really a hunter, but I was always sort of around people that were through that and Boy Scouts and, you know, whatever else, ROTC and things like that. So, you know, I was always fascinated by it and I always wanted to do it because it just seemed like the logical conclusion of being fascinated by animals and wanting to spend time around animals and things like that. And, you know, I was a big fisherman and it just seemed like a logical next step. Mm-hmm. So the first time I went hunting was probably in college. And, you know, I got a whitetail back east in Virginia with a friend. And then, you know, that was really neat. It was a really cool little, you know, just introduction to, you know, standard Eastern hunting. And, you know, hunting was definitely always one of those things that I always wanted to get more into. And, you know, when you live in Hollywood and, you know, going into the woods is a couple hour drive and your friends don't maybe hunt, you know, the barrier to entry for hunting is very high.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was not really until I was out here in California and was offered some opportunities to tag along with, you know, by the time I sort of met people that were able to facilitate me tagging along, to go out and get a pig. And, you know, from there I was like, oh man, I can do this. Like, this is something like I'm at a point in my life where this is financially accessible to me. You know, I'm prepared to put in the drive or the travel time to get places that have animals. And, you know, this is a really cool thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you've written about the fact that hunting is a difficult sport to get into, especially when you're, kind of outside the bubble, if you will. Besides, like,
yeah,
the access and the knowing someone who hunts, like, what are the other barriers that you see? Is it those things you mentioned in sort of like time and money? Or are there other things that you, like, from a knowledge perspective, that outsiders find hunting intimidating?
If you think of your sort of prototypical American hunter, it's somebody who lives close to the land and probably gets food as a very cheap alternative to shopping at the store, right? you know, so a deer costs them, you know, a 30 cent bullet and, you know, maybe the tree stand I buy once every 5 years is some camo. And they go out on a friend or, you know, on a friend's land or a buddy's land or their own land and just get a deer. And, you know, imagine what that looks like for somebody who lives in a city, you know, pays $2,000 a month in rent or whatever people pay these days, you know, can barely afford their car payment, much less, you know, the fee to go to a gun range outside the city, which requires traffic, you know, sitting in, you know, travel and sitting in traffic and a hunter education course and an expensive rifle. You know, you think about the financial lives of your average city-based young person, and there's not a lot extra there. Mm-hmm. And if there is, it's probably spent on girls and beer and nice clothes. And, yeah. You know what I mean? So just getting the introduction, that, you know, the point where you can shoot competently, or you know how to, like, you know, you spend enough time in the woods that you know how to find a deer, or that you spend enough time in the woods that, like, you're even exposed to any sort of pro-hunting message. It's just so alien. There's just not that crossover. So even if, you know, I have a lot of friends here in Hollywood who are very fascinated by the idea of coming hunting, but even just the investment of time and coming to the gun range with me and practicing with their shotguns so they can come bird hunting, or picking up $1,000, you know, Weatherbee loophole scope package, you know, so they can go get a larger animal, is just so far outside of anything that seems practical to them that it's a very difficult commitment to make.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. Like, I could see with, you know, the food movement and things like that, where that younger, more urban crowd has more of an interest in hunting. But, I mean,
totally.
There's definitely a barrier to entry when you didn't grow up with it. You know, it's not like,
yeah,
you know, grandpa went out and taught you necessarily when you were eight and handed you down his 30-30 lever action. Like, that's my story. And if I didn't have that... Yeah. And was starting from scratch, like you said, it's the time, it's the money. That's a huge barrier.
And who do you go with? You know, right. So you're some guy who lives, you know, let's say you live in Brooklyn and you really like the idea, you know, you've been exposed to the message of, like, you know, healthy, humane, ethical, you know, wild caught meat. You, man, that's cool. That's for me. You know, who do you go with? Like, who do you say, hey, you want to invest a couple $1,000 and, you know, several weeks of our time and, you know, going around in the woods in camo and looking like a bunch of rednecks? Mm-hmm. You know, it's such a difficult.
Oh, and by the way, it's not guaranteed that you're going to get anything.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. And you're probably are going to come home empty-handed, and yeah, your girlfriend's going to be mad at you.
Yeah. So, are there any programs or any movements that you've seen that are enabling that to happen, or it's really just kind of a more of a one-on-one? Like, you kind of have to.
Gotta be a one-on-one thing,
yeah.
You know. I look around my peer group, and there's a lot of us at sort of the same level, where, you know, maybe we had a little exposure to hunting growing up. Maybe we want to do it now. Maybe we just want to do it better. And it's all of us sort of like trying to talk each other, like, "Hey, okay, this weekend we've been planning this. This is our deer hunting weekend. We've got the tags. We're staying at a friend's cabin. You know, we've worked on this together, and we're encouraging each other." And that's really where it sort of come from for me, is having that kind of thing. And then making, you know, as I, you know, I'm very fortunate in that, you know, I travel around the world and do awesome shit with rad people. And, you know, some of those people are able to sort of help me out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like meeting guys who are like Army Rangers hung up in Washington, who were like, you know, dude, you got to come with us. And then like put up with like me being an ignorant jerk the entire time. You know, yeah. They're like, "Oh, you're holding your gun upside down." You know
what? Yeah,
what mistake is made, and they can be patient about that and put up with me tagging along. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And not many people have those ingredients.
Right. Yeah, that's a good lesson for us, though. Just a reminder of that, the personal reaching out and taking some of our own hunting time, which is hard for most of us to find. But if we can, like, say, take 10% of it and focus that on trying to get somebody new involved and being that patient sort of mentor, it would certainly help.
Even if it's just being patient, answering questions, because there's, you know, it's one of those worlds where there's not a lot of guidance out there for all the really, you know, sort of obvious questions for beginners.
Yeah.
You know, where do I go? How do I set up a tree stand? How do I stalk? You know, do I need to buy this camo? Is that necessary? You know, oh, scent control, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
You know, it's just, there's not a whole lot of guidance out there. And a lot of the publications and a lot of the media in the space, you know, speaks to guys that have been doing their whole lives. They're like, "Yeah, you got to get a deer. It's awesome."
Yeah.
You know, right. And yeah. if existing hunters can do one good thing for hunting, it's if they even in their entire career as a hunter just help one person get into it, it's the best thing any of us can do.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean that's a balance that is difficult to strike even with this show, because we try and dive like super deep into the guys who are most into it and most dedicated to it and who already are experienced, and then try and take that further, because like that's what we're doing, is we're hunters that we're trying to learn from our guests. And so a lot of times we get into these deep topics. At the same time, we are cognizant of, man, like a lot of what we're covering, if you don't have context or familiarity or some base knowledge, it's like probably way over your head.
Exactly.
And so even in this moment, like you guys listening to this, if you were new to concepts or you have like stupid questions, I would love to do, you know, an episode on like beginner stuff. So just for you guys who are listening, to interrupt the show, if we can, go ahead and email us to podcast@exomountaingear.com, and we would love to do, you know, shows and topics that are all about those beginner things. I think that would be really cool. So yeah, you mentioned, you know, this younger demographic, and obviously the context that you're in, you know, where you live in Hollywood and the mainstream areas that you've written. And it's kind of interesting that the more public you have gone in recent years with your hunting in terms of writing about that has been in the midst of some controversies, such as the whole Cecil the Lion chaos.
Oh God, yeah.
Which you kind of like got thrown in the middle of, right? So
yeah.
Talk a bit about like maybe some of what you've gone up against. And I don't say that like in a way that you're against them, like, and that you vilify them, because I think you do a very good work about, although they might be very against what you for, like you stand a very solid, reasonable ground. But just kind of talk about those interactions of being in the mainstream media and writing for these publications and being the hunting guy who probably takes a beating.
Oh yeah. I mean, you have to understand that, like, you know, it's funny to talk, especially during this, you know, election cycle right now, people talk about the liberal media. Most of the media is made in cities by people who wear suits and, like, you know, go to fancy restaurants and drive Toyota Priuses and, you know, that kind of thing. They're not from Missouri. They're not from Arkansas. They're not from Washington State. And a lot of the time, for, you know, one of the shows that I went on to talk about Cecil was Dr. Drew. You know, their audience is normal people as well, not people who are exposed to nature. And it's very beneficial for media a lot of the times to draw moral judgments, because it helps get people riled up. It helps engender
hype cycle.
Yeah, it hype cycle. It helps engender, you know, people being, you know, engaged and, you know, spending time on your site and blah blah blah. And, you know, you're just feeding a beast of ignorance, really, in the pursuit of just sort of agreeing, having this mass agreement or this mass hype about, you know, something stupid. And being one of those people and being, you know, in some small position of respect in that world and coming in with an alternative view is honestly actually an opportunity, because I'm, you know, one of the few people in LA who, you know, is known to the show producers and can go on the shows and, you know, speak intelligently about the subject. And there's just not a lot of people like that. I can go on the show and be a peer. I'm not, you know, a Duck Dynasty dude.
Right.
And so that it's actually helped a lot being able to do that and hopefully get a pro hunting message, or help, you know, help people just maybe think critically about these things that they're just so knee jerk about.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that like some of what you've written about and like those appearances on shows, it's like you're a voice of reason among what a lot of times is just emotional outrage, I would say.
Yeah, just caterwauling about, you know, a bunch of like, you know, I'm upset because I think lions are cute and one was killed.
Right.
And that's like the extent of thought that people put into this. And like we as hunters, we have to understand that normal people are normal. We're the exception. You know, we've gone out and become more enlightened about animal conservation. And if we're going to change people's opinions, we can't get mad at them. We can't shut them out. We can't just call them ignorant. Those things may be true, but you need to help them understand what our thinking is and what our world is like from their perspective, and sort of in baby steps.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I think is helpful is you try and make a very informed, case about the good of hunting and of conservation. Mm-hmm. It's something that, you know, I see someone like you do that, and we have, you know, other folks who are great advocates for hunters in that way, guys like Steven Rinella, for sure, who make that great case. Yeah. But what are some of those, like, if you are, you know, dealing with a non-hunting audience or even one-on-one, kind of give us the breakdown on how you approach the value in the good of hunting and the arguments that you would make for hunting and it being positive thing. You don't need to go into a big spiel, but like what's a good approach to share with those folks?
I have this conversation like every damn day. Yeah. So it's like, you know, like even today I was just having this conversation on Facebook. A friend in Spain posted a picture of a deer he just got on my Facebook wall and was like, hey, you know, come over next year with me and we can hunt on my farm. And then, you know, another friend sees that and that's terrible. I don't understand how you ever do that. And, you know, how do you do that to animals, blah, blah, blah. The conversation always starts with, you know, you guys have to understand what conservation is. It is managed use. And without value, you know, nature doesn't have a reason to exist in our very cold reality of a human populated world. And so by applying a value to these animals, we are motivated to conserve them. And then the actual, you know, moving parts of conservation with, you know, the carrying capacity and, you know, how tags are determined and issued by zones, you know, to, you know, bring animals back to that carrying capacity is sort of the next step in that argument. You sort of lose them about there because their eyes glaze over because the conversation's taken more than 10 seconds and, you know, isn't a BuzzFeed listicle. But, you know, one of the points you can always hit on is, you know, in large part isn't actually due to us because, you know, gun sales are booming right now for political reasons. But the result of that, that's good for us hunters, is that the Pittman-Robertson tax that's applied to firearms and bullets and such is at record levels. So last year, you know, Pittman-Robertson raised $1.1 billion for animal conservation in America. And that's a huge sum of money that is not spent on like $1 million, you know, CEO of a $1 million salary of a CEO or on advertising or anything like that. It just goes directly to animal conservation. It pays for fish and game. It's what pays for anti-poaching efforts, what pays for habitat rehabilitation. And you compare that $1.1 billion sum to the budgets of some of the world's largest wildlife conservation charities. You know, like the WWF, the World Wildlife Fund, is the biggest animal conservation charity in the world, and its annual budget is, off the top of my head, something like $228 million a year. That's spent worldwide, and a lot of that's spent on like carbon abatement and advertising and, you know, paying staff and, you know, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And, you know, $228 million worldwide pales in comparison to $1.1 billion spent right here in America.
Yeah.
And so I always try to like explain to people, like, you know, hunting is why we have big animals in America. It's why we have the deer. It's why we have the antelope. It's why we have the cougar. It's why we have the bear. It's why we have the elk. And if you're able to just like say something quick like that, that's a soundbite, they might not believe you at the time, but the next time they're sort of exposed to a hunting message, they might remember you saying that and maybe hopefully think a little, you know, a little more critically about what they're, where they're going with their outrage.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Something, you know, that you've written about, which, you know, hunters will certainly get, but I'm curious about how this has been received by non-hunters is, you know, you basically state the fact that you don't hunt because you hate animals or nature, but because you love them. And like audience hearing that's probably like, yeah, totally. But to others, that's probably such an insane statement. Like,
yeah, you went in the woods and you killed Bambi's mom. How dare you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is the response to something like that?
It's difficult, you know, especially here, like in the city. You know, I'm single, I'm always trying to date girls, and, you know, I've got an antelope trophy above my bed.
Yeah.
There's gotta be a little explanation before they see that, right?
There's kind of like a taxidermy thing going on with hipsters though, right? I mean, there's a little bit
there totally is, but it's one thing to like buy something at a vintage store, like, right. Oh, I got a steer head, and it's one other thing to be like, I shot that in the heart.
Right, yeah. You know? Yeah.
So there's gotta be a little bit of an explanation. People are honestly been very open to it. Once, you know, all this level of explanation come around, you know, I have a wonderful dog that goes everywhere with me and is sort of very well known and much more popular and more well respected than I am. And so people sort of think, you know, here in Holland, people think of me as the animal guy.
Yeah.
you know, I'm the guy that babysits their dogs. I'm the guy that has the best dog in town. I'm the guy that'll come rescue an animal or, you know, do that kind of thing. And so when they hear that I hunt, they're often like, well, you know, wow, really? We thought you loved animals. And it's like, well, I do. This is part of it. And this is why. And then hopefully, you know, all this bigger message that we're discussing on the show can sort of inform a conversation. And, you know, you being a positive role model in general is maybe some of the best way to help people be like, oh, wow, I thought hunters were horrible people, but you're a nice guy. You know, what's the disconnect here?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think just hearing all this, the big takeaway is, for me, it's like, it's common sense. Like, be nice. Don't be a jerk.
Totally.
Be willing to have a conversation, not just to, like, yell bullet points at somebody.
Yeah, don't just call somebody names. Don't call them ignorant. Don't you know? Yeah. Be like, hey, you're a liberal and I'm conservative, and we have no common ground. It's like, well, we're probably actually like 99% agreed on everything, you know.
Yeah.
You know, why don't we find that common ground rather than talk about our differences?
Yeah. Well, it's like, yeah. I mean, it's just kind of like we were talking about before the recording, the political environment, the whole idea that as Americans we can like disagree and discuss it without just labeling each other and going crazy. It's like we all rail against that fact that we're so divided, but I see very few people who are like sitting down going, yeah, we are divided, so let's work through it. Like, let's talk about it. Let's not be the person who's just slamming the other side, you know? Like, we need to have that approach, I think, is if we're gonna be good ambassadors, if you will, of hunting.
Exactly. It's instead of jumping to conclusions about somebody or, you know, being mean to them, just be nice and try to understand where they're coming from, and, you know, see them as somebody who's not an enemy, but a potential convert and a potential future hunter.
Yeah. I think, you know, this for me, this always, like, the rubber really hits the road, because many of our listeners probably aren't going to be in Hollywood tomorrow and not have to deal with this, but most of our listeners, when they go to hit the backcountry, they're going to run into people at the trailhead who are hikers or bird watchers or something who might very well be non-hunters, who might very well be anti-hunting. So, like, each of us, even if we're not in Hollywood, we all have those opportunities, if you will, where we run into the non-hunting public and have a chance to, you know, be a good voice for hunting.
Oh, totally. And I'm sure, you know, everybody listening to this show has probably had the same experience as of you. But, you know, you're walking out of the woods or walking, you know, you cross a trail and there you are, the guy in camo with a gun or a bow. And there's a family or some girls on a hike or something like that. And they, you know, they give you nasty looks. And instead of trying to be scary or intimidating or blow them off or whatever it is, you know, smile and say hello and, you know, just be like, hey, how are you guys doing? Need anything? You know, and try to be a good ambassador. I think it's all of our responsibility to try to be a good ambassador for our sport.
Yeah. So I would love to dive into some of the stories that you've written about Wes and the black bear hunt, which we talked about. you went back for redemption for just this past fall. But let's talk about that initial black bear hunt. You know, you kind of mentioned that, you know, you were worried about going on that and writing about it just because the effect of what that might be.
Yeah. But I mean, that was just after Cecil.
Yeah.
So it was like literally like the whole world was just like, oh my God, hunting is awful. You know? And you're like, oh, here I am. I've just like taught myself a new sport. You know, in that case, archery, you know, I've invested, you know, $5,000 in this. And you know, by the time I'm done with all the bow and accessories and, you know, range time and arrows and, you know, blah, 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 you know, and I'm going to go do this. I'm going to get fired from my damn job. You know, for like pictures of a dead bear and like the ensuing social media outrage.
Yeah, and there's something about bears too that I think the non-hunting public sees bears differently in many cases than like, you know, your average whitetail.
Exactly.
So they're more sensitive to it.
Yeah, with a whitetail, you can definitely more easily get the food argument across.
Yeah.
You know, I was very carefully hunting a bear that ate berries and roots and stuff like that to have a good tasting bear. And I was, you know, going to eat it and use it all and make a rug and make a little necklace for my 5-year-old nephew or one of the claws. You know, it's all the fun stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, really use the animal and try to get the best possible death, et cetera. But, you know, people just see that those big eyes in the Disney cartoon and, you know, bears are cute and don't kill them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was something I had a lot of conversations about with a lot of people in my life, and, you know, it was definitely very controversial. You know, I got a good shot on the bear thanks to my friend scouting on my behalf. and I missed it. You know, which probably actually worked out for the best. And in that case, it was still, you know, a great week of hunting with a new buddy. And now we're really good friends and, you know, still time in the woods and, you know, time running around with bows and arrows and, you know, nothing wrong with a hunt. You don't bring something home.
Absolutely.
But, you know, yeah, it was definitely a very, emotionally charged, you know, time to be out there bear hunting for a week just after Cecil.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, you've written about, I think even in that article, that, you know, to most people, nature is something that's just observed, but to you, it's, yeah, you want to be a part of nature.
That's something that we as hunters can all relate on is, you know, we're out there, you know, experiencing the world as a bear does, or, you know, trying to be smarter than one or trying to be sneakier than one. And we all know how difficult that is. You know, everyone might laugh at us, but like, you know, outside of our urban environment, you know, we're not top dog.
Yeah.
And that's a huge part of hunting to me is, you know, I remember, like, after, you know, I thought that I'd shot the bear and there was a big blood trail. And I basically just put an arrow, like one blade of the broadhead through its brisket was what our end conclusion was. So there was a blood trail and went into this giant blackberry thicket. And me and my buddy Griff, who's a retired Army Ranger, spent like 8 hours of our lives on hands and knees crawling through bear tunnels in this blackberry thicket, you know, just getting cut to shreds, shredding our clothing. You know, I found the bear's den and crawled down inside with my knife in my mouth, you know, like an thinking it was gonna be like dead.
So well. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I put my hand through an underground bee's nest and got stung like 100 times. And, you know, like, just, it's just, you know, you're really out there doing something in the woods with a purpose and, you know, with a positive purpose and really interacting with nature on its terms. And that's really especially in this age of everybody working on computers and sitting inside all the time, a really great fundamental challenge to, you know, where we come from as humans.
Yeah. So I'm curious about, what are your perspectives on trophy hunting? And obviously that means different things to different people, but when you hear that, like, what are your thoughts?
It's one of those that, you know, every conversation that I have with a non-hunter where they want to rant and rail about trophy hunting and how evil it is, you sort of have to agree with them, just at least on a surface level to start, you know, develop that connection, that level of agreement, and then you sort of back them into that, like, it doesn't really matter what a hunter's motivations are, what they're going out to get, you know, because the system of hunting is so universally positive and so good for the animals, whether that be here in Africa, that, you know, even if you're just going over there to hunt a lion, you're basically funding lion conservation to the tune of $50,000 plus. You know?
Yeah, it's a decent contribution. And
that's not a bad thing. It's probably more than they donated to lion conservation last year.
Yeah.
You know? Right. So you sort of you want to disagree publicly with trophy hunting to a certain degree, just because it does suffer that bad image. And then you use that sort of disagreement to back people into, you know, hey, maybe this isn't so bad.
Yeah.
I'm largely not a trophy hunter, primarily because I'm not a rich dude and taxidermy is expensive. And, you know, going after some of these really big, you know, great looking animals is expensive. I just want to go out and fill my freezer with meat.
Yeah.
You know, that's really my goal. I've got a couple trophies these days. You know, I've got a European mount, black tail in the front of my front porch, to scare all my friends that come over. You know, I've got an antelope hanging over my bed and I've got a few other things. And, you know, I really take pride in it. It's a memory for me. It's a connection to that world for me. And it's, you know, here in Hollywood, it's also a big middle finger to people that might break into my house or cause trouble in my parties or something like that. you know, like, hey, this guy's arm knows how to use it.
Right.
You know, yeah. The local police love me. I came home with an animal last year. I think it was probably the blacktail. And I gave them all little gift bags with a couple pounds of venison sausage in it.
Nice.
And they're like, how'd you get this? And I was like, with a bow and arrow. And they're like, oh, man.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So I'd love to dive into that archery topic and bow and arrow, because that's something, speaking of, like, you know, barrier to entry and something that can be intimidating. What was your experience? Because I know that, you know, you primarily hunted with a shotgun and a rifle. And then, as you even mentioned, prepared really for that bear hunt and dove into archery. What was that like for you?
Yeah, so I met this guy, Griff, and Griff and I have become very good friends. He's a retired Army Ranger guy, very well respected in that world. And I wrote a story about him and his company, Combat Flip Flops. It was very popular. We sold out his entire inventory for the year, put 61 girls in school in Afghanistan as a result. And you know, he wanted to do me a favor in return, so he invited me on an archery bear hunt in Washington. And I had like 6 months to get ready for it. I'd never shot a compound bow before. You know, I last shot archery and Boy Scouts on some like bullshit, you know, fiberglass, you know, piece of junk. So I went to Oak Tree Gun Club, which is a fantastic local gun. We probably, you know, you wouldn't think of it, but Los Angeles probably has one of the best gun clubs in the world. And Oak Tree is just a fantastic place. And sought out the archery pro there. And I was like, hey, you're going to teach me archery in the next 6 months so I can go on a bear hunt with Special Forces dudes. And he was like, you're on crack.
Yeah, 6 months is not very long.
It's not very long. So I shot every bow in the shop, and I ended up with a PSE Full Throttle, which seems like a crazy bow for a beginner to start on, but it's what I shot best on that day.
That is pretty nuts.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a physically fit dude, and I, you know, I do a lot of sports. So it just this is what felt best. It felt like, you know, it shot so fast, it felt like one of my Weatherbys, where it's a nice, like, flat shooting arc. So I picked that up and put all the accessories on it, you know, best money you could buy. And I spent 5 days a week for 6 months practicing for an hour or more.
Wow.
And I missed my shot on the ultimate hunt. But, you know, that's sort of, you know, the realistic nature of hunting. But I'm a pretty damn good shot now. And I, you know, was better after that 6 months of practice than I am now. But
So did you shoot with that archery pro through that period, or was it you just kind of going self-taught and figuring it out? What was that like?
Yeah, no, Carlos, I mean, he didn't give me, you know, it's archery. There's not a whole lot of formal lessons you can take. You know, he sort of set me on the right path and then would, you know, check in on me occasionally and tell me I was doing it wrong or make fun of me or, you know, tell me a completely unrelated story that wasted my time on the range or, you know,
whatever. Right.
But yeah, he was a huge help. And, you know, I would say it was 90% self-taught and 10% lessons, or, you know, whatever the instruction took the place of, which was mostly sarcasm, but, you know.
Mostly making fun of you as you try to figure it out.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
That's what friends are for.
Exactly. So it was fun. I did a little 3D shooting before I got into that. I'm trying to do more 3D shooting now, but, you know, again, just the whole barrier to entry of like trying to get my car and go someplace on a Sunday morning through traffic for 2 hours to go shoot some bows and arrows is, you know, a little more of a challenge than maybe I wish it was. But yeah, it's a sport that I really enjoy now, that I've helped other friends get into. It's not that difficult to learn. It's definitely a difficult sport. It's not shooting a rifle, you know, where you sort of line things up and, you know, as long as you're not going out to, you know, long ranges, you know, it's not that difficult. It, you know, it takes strength and it takes coordination and, you know, it takes some sort of understandings of physics and how those apply to the real world as things are sort of going really fast. But I like that challenge. You know, I really enjoyed having that in my life for you know, as a new thing for 6 months there. It was really fun to go out and be like, oh, I suck at this. I need to be good enough to do this with Special Forces dudes. Okay.
Yeah, you just got to commit to it and make it happen.
Yeah, you just got to do it. And I don't think it's beyond anybody's ability to figure out. I certainly thought that I wasn't going to be good enough, and I did. I'm pretty good now. Yeah. So, people listening, you know, if you wanted to check out archery, you just got to go shoot.
Yeah.
No, it's not impossible.
Yeah, and once you start, you'll probably be hooked and doing it 5 days a week, just like you did.
Exactly, and if my dumb ass can figure it out, anybody can.
Well, if that's not an endorsement, I don't know what is.
I've got this really funny arm injury on my left arm from one of the mini motorcycle accidents or crashes, I should say. So my whole left arm is like a giant bow shape, and so it gives me that really good natural hold on the grip, where the whole arm just, like, you know, lock my left hand into the grip, my arm just arches out of the way of the string.
Oh, yeah. Got that natural curve.
Yeah, who knew that would ever come handy.
One of the positives of crashing bikes, right?
Yeah, the first step for archery for everybody out there listening should be to crash motorcycles like several dozen times.
I was going to say, and which one of the accidents was this that actually did it?
I think it's just a compilation of various injuries and how they all came back together into some semi-working arm.
Awesome. Well, I'd love to wrap up with two things that may or may not be related, but One is, what do you feel is like the most important thing that you're in the process of learning as a hunter? And two is, what hunt are you most excited about? Either that, you know, you already know is happening and is coming up, or just something that you want to make happen?
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the big challenge for me right now, you know, I live in California. There's a huge drought. I have a deer tag for locally, and I have a bear tag for locally this year. And honestly, just going out in the woods and being able to find the animals is such a challenge here right now. You know, this isn't Washington State. This isn't back east. You don't walk in the woods and see a deer.
Yeah.
You know, you can go out there. I got a Pacific hybrid deer last year up by Ojai in a place that has like a, like, you know, 3 or 4% hunter success rate. And I talked to a guy on the first day of my shoot, and he'd been up there 4 days, not even seen a deer. You know, and just being able to go out there and figure out where they are, and then, you know, all the skills of getting close to them and all the skills of going undetected are something I will always throughout my entire life try to become better at. Cause that to me is most of the challenge of hunting.
Yeah,
is sure. You know, finding the animals and being able to get close to them. Mm-hmm. And like any skill, like motorcycle riding or like anything like that, it doesn't matter how good you are. You can always get better.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome.
And then, yeah, my upcoming hunts are deer here in D11, which is Angeles National Forest. So literally the mountains like right above LA, like LA suburbs in mountains start, and that's where I'm hunting.
Yeah.
There's really good deer there. It's a popular hunting area, which is one of the challenges. The season's already started, ends on October 6th. I haven't started hunting yet. I've just been traveling. So I'm gonna go this weekend and then the last weekends. Just sort of do spot and stalk, and just through like Google Earth and topo maps and then knowledge from previous hikes and stuff in that area, I have some good ideas of where I think I'll be able to find some success. That'll be rifle on my Weatherby Vanguard, a 240 Weatherby Magnum, I think I'm going to use for that. And then I bought a bear tag. My friends at Weatherby gave me a tip on a little honey hole. Where I can't tell you where it is, but I think I have a pretty good chance of success there.
Awesome.
But with that one, it's going to be, you know, whether I have time to go do it between now and the end of the year.
Yeah.
Because again, you just live in a city and it's, you know, it's a challenge to get out there.
Yeah.
I'm also going to get a pig. One of Outside's editors is this really cool girl, Axie. She's our gear editor, and she just got her first rifle this year, Weatherby Camilla, their new sort of lighter, shorter women's rifle. And so I'm going to take her on a pig hunt up by Paso Robles. Hope everything goes according to plan. We both fill our freezers because, you know, that pig meat is good.
Yeah, that's very cool, man. Well, hey, I so appreciate you taking the time. And, you know, I think I said this even before we recorded, but I appreciate the voice of reason and the way that you represent hunting positively in such a unique way that most of us, you know, you are for sure reaching an audience that our listeners won't reach. You're reaching an audience that many of our hunting people in the media won't even reach, because you just have a whole different, you know, a whole different audience through Outside and through the other places you've written. So I just think it's super cool of what you're doing. I want to thank you for it.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for everything that you guys do. You know, hopefully all together we can help, you know, really transform the image of hunting in this country and, you know, continue to participate in a sport that's, you know, just so positive for the country, for the people that do it, and for the animals.
Yeah. So in addition to following you in Outside Magazine and obviously on their site as well, where can our listeners connect with you on social media or anywhere else?
Yeah, probably the best place is Instagram. It's just at Wes Seiler.
Okay.
And then Twitter as well. I'm not super active on Twitter, but if you really want to follow me on there, I will talk back to you. It's at Indefinite Wild.
Awesome. Wes, appreciate the time, man.
All right, thanks, dude. Speak to you soon.
Before we go, I want to give a big thanks to Greg Freeman for leaving us a review on iTunes. Greg, we want to send you some Exo Mountain Gear swag, so please email us your address to podcast@exomountaingear.com. And listeners, if you're enjoying the show and want to leave us a review on iTunes, you would also be entered into these giveaways. Speaking of Greg's review, he mentioned that he was looking for a future episode on hunting post-rut or late-season elk. Well, Greg, we happen to have recorded just that episode and released it on the previous podcast, exomountaingear.com/55. So episode 55 will take you right to it. And listeners, if you do have any other comments, questions, or feedback, as always, you can email us directly to podcast@exomountaingear.com. Until next time, guys, happy hunting if you're still chasing something. And if not, I'm sure like many of us, we're counting down till that next hunt. Thank you.